the Popmatic Podcast for August 26th, 2015.
This is the end, beautiful friend.
Popmatic Podcast, where you can rock out with your library card out. I am Brian. Joining me today are
Amanda,
Jeremy,
Mike,
Bill.
As you can hear from the echo, we're recording in the Oak Bar at the Hermitage Hotel. Amanda is the only one whose attire satisfies the dress code.
I'm about to be kicked out.
I don't know if there's a dress code.
Sorry,
I have no idea.
President Jackson.
Yeah. You called it a hotel. I thought I was in the wrong place.
Oh, I went to the Hermitage Motel, but I totally fit in with the day you were there.
Pretty different thing, right?
We're scared.
We will be recording in impromptu locations around downtown Nashville while the children's department at the main library is being remodeled. Now, to the task at hand. This isn't really the end. This is just a show about endings. Why? Because everyone knows that August is the end of summer and September is the beginning of fall, no matter what silly star maps say, no matter what metro school schedules say, no matter when library summer reading programs end, the end of August is the end of summer. Everyone knows that. So today, we talk about endings.
Yeah.
You like a good ending, don't you?
Oh, I do. Why, this has come up in the podcast a couple of times. You know, Blood Meridian had a really good ending. I don't know where that came from. Anyway, so today I thought I'd talk a little bit about a show that's near and dear to my heart, Deadwood. It's been on my mind a lot of late, well, with me finally getting the last season of Justified from the library, guest starring Garrett, played two parts in Deadwood, Headland. And then just this last week, Garrett acted in two separate roles in Deadwood, Headland. Tweeted that HBO is in negotiations to finish the series with a finale movie. Oh boy, oh boy. I'll tell you what those two parts were, but that would spoil it, because I didn't really notice it about halfway through the series. Deadwood was a show that aired three seasons on HBO, chronicling life in a sleepy mining town called Deadwood, South Dakota in the late 1870s. The show begins with a snobby rich boy coming from back east, drifting into town, claiming that he has rights to some land that just happens to have a crap ton of gold on it. There's gold in them there hills. The first principal... Oh, I'm not saying that line is crap. Anyway, I could spend the rest of this line praising this show, but alas, I'm sure that would drive even Gary from Perth away from the podcast to focus...
That's big. He's tough.
He's stuck by it this whole time. To focus...
He loves Winston's.
To focus on his didgeridoo. So, I will focus on things that I really like from the show. Ian McShane, as Swearingen the Saloonkeeper, has a standout, brilliant performance. He stole the show to such a degree that the writers made the character bedridden for a big chunk of season two to allow some other actors to shine. While the acting is stellar all around, I spent most of those episodes just wishing for Swearingen to return. I read an article back when the series was first running that said that the show is really big on dualism. Every character has an opposite, you know, like a person who's like basically the same but different, you know, like an evil twin kind of vibe, which I've always liked. It was really fun for me to see parallels in each of the characters. For example, there's a rival saloon keeper called Cy Tolliver, who's played by Powers Booth. You know, both of them, like, you know, both Swearingen and Tolliver are like violent saloonkeeper types, but like, you know, Swearingen will like kill because he feels threatened or like has to, while Tolliver is more like a violent, enjoys killing and violence. You know, Swearingen is also paralleled by Seth Bullock, the sheriff of Deadwood, played by Timothy Oliphant. Both support order in the town, but Swearingen has like no interest in law. Or like, you know, rules and stuff, and like escaped to Dakota territory so the law wouldn't hold him back, you know. Both of them try to become like leaders of the town, but like, you know, Bullock is more like a reluctant type, while like, you know, Swearingen just likes being in charge. Another thing I liked about the show was the language. David Milch, the creator and the writers, went to 19th century literature and letters to recreate a more authentic feeling 19th century style of talking. Everything they say, from the loftiest of philosophies to the most banal of statements, sounds like Shakespeare and required my full attention to like process and like, you know, figure out what's going on, what people are saying. I watched most of the show with my dad. Hi, Dad. And he turned to me once and said something to the effect of like, even the dumbest person in town sounds way smarter than both you and me combined. I was like, that is true. It is also the most cursingest show I've ever seen. The F-bomb has dropped 2,980 times with an average of 1.56 F-bombs per minute.
Did you count? Is this your math?
This is the magic Wikipedia.
Oh.
Supposedly, they made the cursing in the show much worse than it actually was in the 19th century, because what was shocking and risque back then is incredibly tame to us.
They said darn.
You know, lily-livered. Those, you know, in the first couple of episodes, they call the new guy coming into town the dude in the most like disparaging of terms, which caused me to look it up. And it's like, oh, yeah, that's what it meant. So he's such a dude. Much like another show that I love that was canceled too early, Firefly. I haven't actually seen the last couple of episodes, but I've heard that Deadwood just ends. There's no like closure. In the last season, William Randolph Hearst's father comes in, played by Major Dad. I was like, Major Dad? Awesome. Whose name escapes right now because I didn't write it out.
Gerald McRaney.
That guy, Gerald McRaney. He's really cool. He was in an episode of Justified. He's the coolest.
Delta Burke.
Yeah, and you wonder, like, you know, where's this going to go? Because he's bringing in civilization and money and kind of stuff. And then you don't know because it just ends. I know, and you know that Garrett, I'll stop with that Joe Ketlin's tweet means nothing. And that, you know, who knows that if it'll actually ever end. But I can always dream there will be a finale movie or three. What have you got, Amanda?
Okay. Sometimes you read a book that is so great you never want it to end. You read all the notes, including the page at the back that talks about what font was used, just so you can postpone that inevitable post-book malaise just a little bit longer.
I have totally done that. I don't care about fonts at all.
I know, but you just don't want it to end.
But this was made in the Middle Ages. That's really cool. No, no, no. You know. Oh, this author's from Maine. That's great. Oh, no.
He has four dogs. But sometimes you get stuck in the middle of a book that no matter how hard you try, it will not end. Even if it's a good book, it just feels like you've been reading it forever. So last year, a movie called Imitation Game came out and starred Benedict Cumberbatch as Alan Turing. Now, Turing is the guy who figured out a way to crack Germany's Enigma code during World War II, and he's also considered the father of the modern computer. And I didn't realize it at the time, but like all good movies, this one is based on a book, which is called Alan Turing, The Enigma. And when I saw that, I thought, okay, let's read the book first, then I'll watch the movie. Plus, the movie list had about 200 holds on it when it first came out, and I didn't get my hold in right away, so I was 205. So I assumed that I wouldn't have to rush through the book, I'd have plenty of time. And then the book came in. And did you know that the book has about 675 pages in it? It's fairly large. And when it first came in for me last April, I had no idea that it would be so thick. So I jumped right in and started reading because it had a bunch of holes on it. But I only made it about 100 pages in before I had to give it back and share it with other people. I didn't want to.
People, girls.
And I have since put myself back on hold and waded through the list and checked out a bunch of other times trying to get through this thing. And, you know, to get ready for the podcast today, I buckled down and I did my best, and I still only made it to page 257. You know, and I consider myself a pretty fast reader. This is just truly the book that never ends. It goes on and on, my friend.
Some people started reading it and knowing what.
I actually read that for my
damn,
thing.
I knew it! As soon as you did it, I was like, no!
That song gets stuck in my head.
I ruined it!
Good one.
I even so told him I left a spot for you to sing.
I saw you wrote it down.
I did
on your paper,
down.
But I couldn't, like,
I'm so sorry.
You'll never catch me this time.
I can confirm that it says that on our notes. From
I just assumed you'd jump right in with me. But anyway.
I feel like such a jerk.
This round.
Can I play a grumpy card?
Yeah.
I'm so mad that Sesame Street is going to be produced by HBO.
Okay. Isn't that so weird?
Yeah. It's like,
can I play the apropos of nothing card?
You'll bring Al Swearingen.
Yeah.
And you say,
I saw a screenshot of that with Elmo Swearingen in the back. So it's really cool.
To explain that random interjection, it's because I always think about them singing the song that never ends on Sesame Street. I'm sorry, we totally derailed you. You're talking about.
I feel like that was just like the book then. So I know you're thinking, well, Amanda, then why don't you just stop reading it? But it's good, I tell you, it's good. And I will admit that I am not good at walking away from books that I start, even if I'm not enjoying them. But I really am enjoying this one. It's just, there's so much math. And I'm not really mathematical. Like, I don't really, you know, do math.
You sold me. I'm putting my hand and toe on it right now.
So it just, it takes a minute to kind of get through those parts and figure out what the author's talking about. And sometimes I even feel like I need to have won a Fields Medal just, you know, so I can follow the storyline and know what, where it's going.
You have to do a test after every chapter or something like that?
Yeah, there will be a quiz later if you know your group theory. And I'm like, I don't even know what that is.
4 times 4 equals, I don't know.
But, well, sometimes it equals 5, apparently.
What?
I don't know. But whenever I would get lost, I would just ask myself, what would Sheldon do? You know, of course, referring to the Big Bang Theory guys, because they are my math gurus. So even though the summer might be ending and this book is not, I am going to persevere. I really want to get to the parts where he starts his actual code breaking, because I think that's going to be...
You haven't... The code breaking hasn't even come in?
It just started.
He just hit
257 of 600.
It started when he was little. He had to go through grade school, and his friend had to die.
I'd skip ahead to the fun stuff, okay.
But I won't know the math. I won't know what
this
I'm doing.
This is a book, not Oscar bait Hollywood version of this guy's life.
Yeah, we will not talk about my feelings about the movie.
So anyway, in the meantime, the movie actually came through on the hold list, and I got it, and so I watched it.
Hey!
So I cheated, and now I'm always going
to
picture...
Did the end of the movie make you want to throw your popcorn screen?
No, I knew it was coming.
Oh, okay.
Spoiler alert. But now I'm always going to picture Alan Turing as that guy who used to play Sherlock Holmes. So, honestly, for the whole thing, I blame Neal Stephenson for all of this, because I first encountered Alan Turing in his fictional book, The Cryptonomicon, which is another long book I got into and couldn't get out of. And that started me down this whole code-breaking rabbit hole that now I must see through to the bitter end. But maybe next time I think I'll just take the blue pill.
Yeah, Cryptonomicon's a book that's too long but turns out to be good.
Yeah, it has a good really ending, like it, but there's like 15 stories going on.
It took me like 3 weeks to read it or something.
It took me months, but I had the audio and I kept thinking it was going to, I had like the play away, I kept thinking it's going to be over.
Yeah.
And it was like 3 days later.
It's one of those books that's so long that, like, you know, a couple hundred pages in, I'm like, this is great. And another couple hundred pages in, I'm like, oh, this is the worst. I just need to finish this. And then a couple hundred more pages in, I was like, this is great.
Nope, it's great again.
You know, and then it's just kind of, by the end, I settled on great.
Yeah, I liked it, but man.
Yeah.
Took some work.
Yeah, there's 3 pages about the proper way to eat Captain Crunch, which I'll never forget because it's so banal. What do you got, Bill?
Well, since we're discussing the end, I have a philosophical question. What if the ending is only the beginning? Let's ponder that for a moment. Have we pondered that enough?
I think so.
I've pondered out.
I'm talking about the movie Sunset Boulevard, directed by the late, great Billy Wilder, starring William Holden, Gloria Swanson, and Erich von Stroheim.
Yeah.
The movie has an unusual structure. When we see our lead character, Joe Killis, played by William Holden for the first time, he's dead, face down in a swimming pool with paparazzi taking pictures of him. Gillis narrates the movie in flashback. Yes, the movie is told from the perspective of a dead man. Joe Gillis says about his predicament, the poor dope, he always wanted a pool. Well, in the end, he got himself a pool. Sunset Boulevard is a dark comedy, it's a drama, and it's got more than a little film noir thrown in for good measure. It's a gothic Hollywood horror story. Joe Gillis, a down-on-his-luck screenwriter, or as Gillis says in the movie, audiences don't know somebody sits down and writes a picture. They think actors make it up as they go along. Gillis is on the run from a repo man after his car, and he hides out in what he thinks to be a deserted mansion. However, it's occupied by Nora Desmond, played by Gloria Swanson, a silent film star, and her butler, Max, played by Erich von Stroheim. I don't know why I have to do that, but anyway.
You do. It is great.
Yes. Sunset Boulevard is a totally original movie. It doesn't fall into any genre or category. It has some of the best movie dialogue ever written. That's why I've quoted some of it here.
Wait a minute. Haven't I seen you before? I know your face.
Get out, or shall I call my servant?
You're Norma Desmond. Used to be in silent pictures. Used to be big.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
And it's interesting to note the movie didn't start out in the swimming pool. It started out in a morgue scene, in a morgue, and it had the characters in the morgue with sheets over their heads discussing, well, how did you get here? Let me tell you how I got to the morgue.
That was like the original?
That was the original ending. And you can see this on some of the DVDs. They have it. They found the footage.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, when they said they were a little scared of it, when they took it to Illinois to preview it, audiences just busted out laughing.
Yeah.
They thought this was hysterical, so they cut it to the swimming pool. So that did not play in Peoria. just if you haven't seen Sunset Boulevard, it's a good time to check it out. And don't look at it as the ending, but the beginning. Before I pass it to Jeremy, you want to ponder that thought for a while? Okay, Jeremy.
All right.
I want to ponder what's going on. I feel like it's like a typhoon or something.
I think it is probably worth noting
that
the grumbling that you hear is the, can you guess?
The
renovation of the children's department.
I thought we were at the bar.
We're at the Armitage Bar.
I thought they didn't like Sunset Boulevard.
That was the toilet flushing.
We're being
past
best.
All right, folks. It's the end of summer and the days are getting darker. And I'm starting to lapse in. My brain is starting to lapse into hibernation mode, which must be why I bumped into someone's truck in the parking lot yesterday.
Whoa!
That was super great.
Bumper cars.
Yeah. And speaking of cars, I can think of no metaphor for the end of youth and being resigned to maturity than my friend Brandon's song, Now I Drive a Subaru. But today, I'm not going to talk about that song because we don't have it available at the library. I'm going to talk about Jonathan Richman's That Summer Feeling.
I love that song. And actually, that is such a perfect song for the theme of this episode.
Yes!
That I might have to do some creative editing and put your segment last.
I'm going
to
stand up.
Listeners, he is standing up and punching the air.
I actually talked about something completely relevant.
And his face is bright red from joy, I believe.
I would even go so far to say, if you listen to this song and it doesn't just touch you in the smallest little tiny bit of a way,
nope,
you're an evil monster that is a robot.
That's right.
Okay.
That's
right. Before Jeremy tells you about the perfect song for the end of summer, I'm going to tell you about some music that sounds like it was made by monsters. I was going to talk about music, too. I don't know if I can compete with the perfection of that song. But I'm known, I think, for my love of experimental music and sometimes straight-up noise music. And a weird thing happened in the mid-2000s was that noise music became a fad and was, like, written about. Like, Spin Magazine did this whole piece called The Art of Noise. And one of my favorite bands ever, Wolf Eyes, straight up, like, noise band, got signed
to Sub Pop Records.
I mean, that's not like a big major label, but it's as big as you can get and still be considered an indie.
Yeah.
And people were kind of amazed because Wolf Eyes were like straight up noise band. And here's a little bit of their song Black Vomit.
Sound like the Shins.
Wow.
Their label mates. Former label.
So that was off their record Burned Mind, which was the record they put out on Sub Pop. And, you know, the thing that made Wolf Eyes a little different, and even though it is noise, noise music is typically known as just like walls of sound. So like walls of feedback or just textures, you know, people masturbating with effects pedals. But with Wolf Eyes, they had drum machines
Sounds
and tape
fantastic.
Loops. And bass and guitars and horns and a singer. Like, if you went to a Wolf Eyes show, like, you would recognize the songs that they played, even though they were still pretty vicious. You know, you probably wouldn't be into it at all if you didn't have at least a little bit of a tolerance for, like, death metal or, like, post-hardcore or whatever. So. And what I always liked about them is they always, like, mixed that up. It was a little bit more than just, you know, your typical wall of concrete noise band. And, of course, everything must come to an end. The noise music fad went away. Aaron Dilloway left the band Wolf Eyes, and I think that's pretty much the noise music equivalent of John Cale leaving the Velvet Underground. So he was an extremely talented musician that I think actually gave Wolf Eyes that sort of more musical edge that they had over other bands. Aaron Dilloway still makes tapes. He still performs live. He owns a record store in Ohio. He still releases albums and plays music all over the world. The band, of course, never stopped releasing records, but they never had as high a profile as they had whenever they were on Sub Pop. The other members of the band still are extremely prolific. They still make music and make art. So Nate Young releases art and records all the time. And the other member of Wolf Eyes, John Olson, he releases tapes constantly on his American Tapes label. They've actually are approaching 1,000 releases on American Tapes. So basically anytime he jams and records, he puts it out as like a 7-inch record or like a cassette tape or a CDR or something that you could buy from them. Now the band has kept going, even though they're not as popular as they used to be, and this is the big, I'm burying the lead, they actually just signed to Third Man Records, which I'm like, Kraftwerk is playing at the Ryman, Wolf Eyes just signed to Third Man, my musical taste is taking over Nashville. Soon, Throbbing Gristle is going to have a star down on the Walk of Fame. It's just how it's going to work. So the new single, Enemy Ladder, drops September 4th on Third Man Records. Of course, it's Third Man, so it's a 7-inch, but you can stream the song right now on something called the Internet. So you might be thinking, why in the heck would this band be on Third Man Records? And actually, I think it's a really good fit. For one thing, Wolf Eyes are totally DIY. Like, they build their own instruments. They're totally down to earth. They're into Americana, but like the sort of punk rock, skateboarding, spray paint aspects of American culture. And they're from Detroit. So the scene that they came out of before the noise music fad was basically experimental punk jazz jamming in Detroit. And I can remember the guys in Wolf Eyes saying, like, before they started getting national attention, like, they could literally play a show every night in Detroit. So I think Jack White had to know that that was going on. So their new full length, which the single Enemy Ladder is off of, comes out October 30th. And the name of that album is I Am a Problem, Mind in Pieces, which is the perfect album for me. And I am super excited. Wolf Eyes on Third Man Records.
Now Jeremy's back with a song that has no references to vomit.
All right, folks, it's the end of summer and the days are getting darker. I'm going to talk about Jonathan Richman's That Summer Feeling. There are a few versions of this song out there, but my favorite is from his 1992 album, I, Jonathan, and it's available on Hoopla.
That summer feeling, that summer feeling. When there's things to do, not because you gotta. When you run for love, not because you oughta. When you trust your friends with no reason nada. The joy I've named shall not be tamed.
Now, if you don't know Jonathan Richman, you might remember him as the guy singing and playing guitar and There's Something About Mary. Anyone?
Nope.
Okay. But of course, he was also the leader of the Modern Lovers. And he famously changed that band's direction after the release of their first album. It kind of split the group up, and he was the remaining member. And they kind of went to a more childlike, sort of innocent, old-time rock and roll sound. But by the time I, Jonathan was released, Richman was a 41-year-old grown-up. And though this song is sort of full of whimsy, it's anything but childlike. In fact, it's devastating, at least to me. It's like sitting down with... What? It's like sitting down with a kid and telling him, look, you're going to die someday, and it can't be avoided. And as you get older, you're going to keep thinking back on being younger and feeling carefree. And even the most mundane parts of your past are going to seem magical. Not because they were, but because they're gone. And you can't go back to that stuff, but you got to remember that feeling, because if you forget it, you'll be a wreck.
Do I still have to listen to the song?
You can if you want to. This would be a good time to put maybe a clip in from it or something.
Yeah, you're going to put a clip in it, so you're going to have to listen to this song or something.
If you've forgotten what I'm naming, you're gonna long to reclaim it one day. Because that summer feeling is gonna haunt you one day in your life. And if you wait until you're older, a sad resentment will smolder one day. And then that summer feeling's gonna haunt you. And that summer feeling's gonna taunt you. And then that summer feeling is gonna hurt you one day in your life.
It's a heavy song. It's a heavy song, but it has a breezy sound with background vocals that kind of provide a constant hum, like cicadas buzzing in the night. And it sounds like the ending of a perfect summer day, but it's also kind of about the end of every summer day in your entire life ever. You can kind of attach whatever geography you want to it. Richmond sings about evergreen summer topics like cars and girls and catamarans, but that's not the point of the song. The refrain, that summer feeling is going to haunt you one day in your life, is sort of a perfect encapsulation of a loss of innocence and of youth. And nostalgia, but not I'm wearing a Power Rangers t-shirt nostalgia, more like the pain of going home nostalgia that's sort of embedded, or that is the word's origin. It makes me think of the last summer I spent in my hometown, driving back from a party out in the country as my friend, who's now an elementary school principal, hit mailboxes with a baseball bat and playing baseball in the street in front of the state capitol.
He just got fired.
And yeah. I didn't say which one.
You didn't say the name. Yeah.
That's right.
It wasn't your friend Brandon. Nope, wrote a song about driving a Subaru.
That's right. He drives a Subaru. He would never do that.
My best friend, Principal Brandon.
He is not a principal.
Weak.
He has too many tattoos.
Vice principal.
He's a janitor. We were playing baseball in the street in front of the state capitol building and doing other things that don't have to do with baseball. Also, that was 15 years ago, so the statute of limitations.
Forget it.
All right. Those mailboxes done been repaired.
Yeah, destroying a mailbox is a federal crime. He's on the no-fly list. The NSA is spying on his email.
He really didn't destroy any. He just kind of bent it, and we were like, this isn't like it is in the movies.
Yeah, movies, they go flying.
Exactly. Yeah. Stand by Me.
He wasn't going yard.
No, he was not going yard. I was also driving his Volvo very slowly through Bald Knob.
Listen, if you're playing mailbox baseball in a Volvo, that's some kind of party foul. Yeah.
That's why it wasn't good.
A snob card against vandalism?
It was a snob card.
So, anyway, Richmond throws in yet another
this
refrain.
That guy became an elementary school principal, didn't he?
Yep.
He may not actually be a principal, but he does work in a school. I will not say his name. Richmond throws in yet another refrain in the song, insisting you'll throw away everything for it, which is that summer feeling. And somehow it's not the saddest part of the song. He kind of he goes on to describe the sort of confusion of emotions, how if you sort of break your memories down into their component parts, they're not that appealing. But if you put them together, you get this certain feeling, which is that summer feeling. I was using quote fingers when I said those parts that I was obviously emphasizing. Jonathan Richmond is living proof that a song can do all the things they do in movies, on records, and even when you're standing in the grocery store. They say a lot, so you don't have to. And the rest of you jerks will probably hate this song. Hey guys!
What's tickling your wait? How do we do
that? What
do we do on Tickle My Fancy?
Well, maybe the library has it. Maybe the library doesn't. But either way, it's tickling our fancy.
Jeremy,
don't you have something to say?
All right, tickling my fancy this week. Somehow I haven't been able to process any prose for the last couple of months other than like occasional emails and things.
That makes being a librarian hard.
Yeah, it makes being a reader hard. So it's with great relief that I can say I cracked open Brent Hendricks' memoir, A Long Day at the End of the World, and just kept on going. Hendricks tells the story of his very personal connection to a horrible event uncovered in northern Georgia, maybe Mike knows this, in the early part of this century. The bodies of 339 people scheduled for cremation were found on the grounds of the Tri-State Crematory in Noble, Georgia in 2002.
Yep.
Among them was Hendricks' father. The owner of the crematorium, also weirdly named Brent, like the author, gave families a mixture of concrete dust and some other stuff, and then stored the remains of the bodies in storage sheds, in the woods, on the ground, and in vaults that were submerged in a nearby lake. I hadn't heard of this story prior to... Well, I saw this book when it came in a couple of years ago, when it came out a couple of years ago on the shelf, and thought it sounded good. I checked it out a few times. Well, thought it sounded interesting.
This sounds great. Because
it's some, you know, it's a memoir of this, of, you know, and it's it's called like Long Day at the End of the World, and the subtitle is like Revelation and Desecration in the Deep South. And I was like, sounds great.
I'm coming with Brian. I'm gonna put my hold on it right now. That totally
sold it. That's summer
feeling. Yeah, exactly. So, and I it sounded good, but like I kept going back to it, never got it, and then. Finally just started reading it, and you know, and I hadn't heard of it, probably because I wanted to sleep at some point between 2002 and now, and this changes everything. This is a horrifying story. The sort of middle part where I am now, I have not finished
it.
The middle part of it is more focusing on like his relationship with his dad and growing up and stuff. And he's going to get back to the horror pretty soon.
There's going
to
be a virus and all the bodies are going to come alive! Exactly.
Well, I missed that part when I lived in Georgia. Yeah. Why do you think I left?
Well, that's why they filmed The Walking Dead. It's a terrifying, terrifying, horrible story. I'd never heard of it, so it's...
But check your copy out today!
Yeah!
Ding!
Amanda.
Okay, so we've pretty much established that if the PopMedic podcast ever becomes more news-oriented, I would definitely be on hand to cover the weather department. We're still trying to figure out sports, but the weather is under control.
You watch baseball, that's enough.
That's true, Brian likes football. So to that end, there is a new reality TV show on TBS called America's Next Weatherman. I have to say, it's piquing my fancy. What? I can't even say it's tickling my fancy because I'm not really sure that I finger quotes get it. The premise is just like every other reality show. There's a dozen or so contestants. They face off on stupid weather-related challenges in order to win prize money. And there's supposedly a brief spot as the weatherman on CNN, because I know when I want weather, I go to CNN.
Oh, yeah. Al Roker's like, you know, you really don't have a lot of chemistry with Snowbird. So, like, I'm sorry. I thought that was funny.
You stand in front of a green screen. How many challenges could there be? So can you point to the sun?
It's brought to you by Funny or Die. Like, they're the producers of this.
How many weather patterns can you draw on the show? Genitals.
I can't really tell if they mean it to be funny or not. And so from what I've read online, like, the producers say this is like totally legit. This is on the level. There really is the contestants are not plants. They're real people. But it's so hard to believe because I've only seen the episode, but it's such a bad combination of like The Office, which I hated, and like The Daily Show. Like it's kind of. So there's like there's a creepy pastor guy. There's one guy that calls himself Frankie 5% because he supposedly has 5% body fat. There's a beauty queen, Miss Ohio. It's like weird. And so I think I'm going to give it one more try because the creepy pastor guy got kicked off.
My feeling is, it's called
he's a fan of Entourage, and
he's the one that doesn't get pointing at a map. Like he has trouble with that.
I don't know how.
But so if somebody out there can explain this to me, I would super appreciate it. I think this would have been a great idea for a reality show, but it's just really awkward. It's not funny. Like it's just awkward, and I think that I'm more voting for Die than funny right now. But if you want to check it out, it's on Saturday nights on TBS at like 10 or 11. That's like on the late.
It's on demand too.
It is on demand too. So if someone would explain it to me, I would be your friend.
I always love Amanda's recommendation of reality shows because they're always just like.
They
ate a roach.
That was shocking. I want this to be funny, but it's not.
I want them to put them in a rain slicker and a wind tunnel and see how
it's
many.
Gonna
they
happen.
Yeah.
They can.
They
that's
going
to happen
that.
Apparently. Like I've seen seen that happen on the Weather Channel. Like where
and then so how much wind could you take
away.
And then also like how how well can you deal with like street people harassing you like live on air?
Well, the
like
first
some
challenge
drunk frat boy is throwing beer on you.
The first challenge, they had to hold a microphone up and then they had put weight on the bottom of it and then they kept like splashing them with water and like they had to like every so often say, "This is so-and-so reporting for Channel 4 News. Back to you, my like," and like it was like 45 minutes. Like they were sitting, like they had the clock right at the bottom. Like they had to stand there. Like I'm like,
huh?
No. So.
You allowed to smoke a cigarette between takes.
First of all,
Mike, what's tickling your fancy?
Hey kids, I thought I'd give your ears a break this week and recommend a comic book. Ooh, oh, taking the throne from Jeremy.
Watch
who,
the throne.
Who I don't think, did you recommend? No comics. I don't know. Comics. Whoa, scary. Called God Hates Astronauts.
Okay, I just want to interrupt and say that I got this for him through our library loan, yeah. So I get half a point on my side.
Well, you got me volume two. I got volume one through the library.
Okay.
Then you can check it out today. You know. God Hates Astronauts, written and drawn by Ryan Brown. It's kind of like an Adult Swim version of the Avengers or the Venture Brothers with a slightly more costumed superhero bent and way more cursing and naked people. This one is going to be kind of tricky to summarize, but here it goes. It's about a team of superheroes called the Power Persons Five and their attempts to stop immortal prize fighter John L. Sullivan, who is an actual guy, and his team of super intelligent bears from doing something. I think he's robbing a bank. At one point, he tries to take over the world. You know, whatever. The leader of the group, Starfighter, gets his head beaten so badly by Sullivan in the first issue that it swells to the size of the rest of his body and has the consistency of a garbage bag and starts, like, drooping on people and stuff. It's really gross. One of the team members is called the Anti-Mugger, whose parents were mugged outside of a movie theater when he was a kid, which caused him to go into one-man war against muggers. And there's a panel that's exactly like Batman, where, like, he's a little boy
Batman
on the street, and his parents are, like, have, like, those giant cartoon, like, bumps in their heads and stuff, and he's all like, no! There's King Tiger eating a cheeseburger, ruler of the galaxy, who looks like a person with a tiger head wearing a crown and eating a cheeseburger. There's Gnarled Winslow, the original Bill Johnson dad character from Family Matters, but with gorilla arms. There's Sir Hippothesis, a hippo man who's conquered most of the world in the 19th century and has an army of animals, and is also the head of NASA, of course. These are just some of the characters that are floating around God Hates Astronauts. There's cursing and violence and weird sex. It's not safe for work or children. It's bonkers and over the top in a super fun way. Oh boy, we don't have the second volume yet, but that's what Amanda's ILL department is for. Yeah, and I always wrote woo woo, which you just said.
Yes. We're psychic today.
Yeah, you know, it's a callback from the last. What do we got, Bill?
Beer. Well, tickling my fancy is the meeting of the Killer Thriller Book Club,
which will be held
Thursday, September 3rd at high noon or 12 o'clock, in which we will discuss the novel The Moving Target by Ross McDonald. This was the novel to introduce Gumshoe Lou Archer. Crystal Dean will lead the discussion. Bring your lunch, and let's have a thrilling conversation.
Nice.
Not a killing conversation.
You guys did an awesome job last week.
Woo.
After you did joke names, you did not say your real names.
We assumed our listeners were smart enough to figure it out.
You know,
Bill said his real name.
Bill's real name.
Gold star for Bill.
You know, I'm Jeremy. And
I'm Mike.
I think you were Crystal.
Oh, I was Crystal.
You were Crystal. I was Brian. You
or
me.
I tried to sound like Crystal. I tried to sound like Crystal when I said it, and I realized I sound nothing like Crystal.
I
should have said like Amanda things like, you know, music and music romance novels.
Treble, bass.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
There was...
C-clef.
Can you confirm is that a thing? Okay.
Yeah,
okay. I'm just waiting.
Totally made that up. It is totally a thing. It's been popular.
Has been used since medieval times.
That's not right.
We could do an episode where we impersonate one another.
I proposed that one for
afraid.
A while.
Yeah. We do like a Secret Santa.
We
episode.
Always like put it off for so long.
That'd be kind of
great. To draw your item on
everybody put an idea in the hat, and then you're like, oh god, I got to read like history of polar exploration.
in graphic novel form.
Yeah,
I would do that.
That'd be
cool. Oh, that could be fun. I've got to read a NASCAR romance. All right.
Who picked that? No one would ever pick that.
So the other thing too that happened in the last episode, there was a callback to a joke about me not wearing pants, which was cut. The actual joke itself was cut. I'll just let listeners imagine what that joke could have been about. All right. So any other corrections?
I don't recall any.
Okay. For more information about pants,
surfing,
and music, you can go to
www.library.nashville.org.
And our theme music is by
Adam Dean.
All right. Next week, if this episode was all about endings, maybe we can find new life in our Labor Day episode.
Jonathan Richmond, thank you very, very much, mate. And you're on tonight at the Trade Union Club in Sydney.
Yeah.
Let's give that a mention. Try and catch him. He did kill them the other night with John Cale.
So they're dead, but you can still come.
Right. But John Cale and yourself are now sort of breaking up and you're going your way. And John, you're off to Brisbane, Melbourne tonight. How did you first meet?
It was a long time ago in California under strange circumstances.
Please tell.
Well, like, he was a fan of Velvet Underground for a long time, and I was really embarrassed by that because it was when I heard his music. I mean, it's embarrassing to hear that somebody likes another kind of music when they're talented themselves.
Yeah.
And the kind of music that he was doing was exactly that fragile, weak sister kind of.
Right. Do you prefer to work live solo or live with the band, Modern Lovers?
Oh, if I could have had the whole Modern Lovers here, they'd be here.
Right.
But the funny thing is, solo works pretty good for TV. Like, if there was a big dance hall situation, then I'd definitely miss the band, but this works pretty good.
How would you describe the blend between yourself and John?
Kind of like Bozo the Clown opening for John Paul Sartre.